I failed a lot at school. Never, you know, they never passed me because I failed a lot. But school almost gives you the intuition that, you know, if you're not a success, you're a failure. Failing is a gateway to success. There are no people who succeed without passing through that. But what is the problem with failure? Why is it so dark? It's very shameful to fail. We don't have an innate humility as human beings to accept it, that couldn't do this. And here is where you need to fail.
Welcome back to Wise On Air, the show where we talk to the world's leading minds on the future of education. My name is Bassem Hijazi, producer of the show. In today's rapidly evolving landscape, it is more important than ever to bring voices who challenge our traditional education paradigms in a bid to seek out new perspectives on learning, success, and personal growth. Our guest today is Abdullah Abu Sheikh, a young entrepreneur from the Middle East who challenges conventional notions of education and advocates for a more dynamic, resilient approach to learning and problem solving. Abdullah is the founder of AstroTech, a pioneering technology company who are building the MENA region's first ultra platform, an ecosystem for digital communication and commerce that will revolutionize the way people live their everyday lives. For an entrepreneur driving such an ambitious initiative, what would their relationship with education look like? Despite not fitting into the traditional schooling mold, Abdullah has gone on to achieve remarkable success as an entrepreneur. His experience has led him to question the effectiveness of current education models in preparing individuals for the real-world challenges they will face. In this episode, Wise director and host Elias Felfoul delves into Abdullah's thoughts on the importance of learning from failure, the need for entrepreneurs to take responsibility for solving problems in their communities, and the potentially transformative impact of AI on education and the job market. So join us as we explore the future of education through the lens of an entrepreneurial trailblazer.
Abdullah, it's such a pleasure to meet you in person. You've been doing some fantastic work in the world of fintech. Just before getting into understanding a little bit more what you do with AstroTech and Botim, I just want to know, growing up, what shaped your entrepreneurial mindset? And who was Abdullah in a classroom? If you go back, you're between 6 and 10. I give you 4 years.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me. I think it's a very interesting question. Who was I in a classroom? I wasn't in the classroom most of the time. I remember by my graduation from high school, our headmaster pulled me up and said, "You have missed more classes than you've attended." And they had a big issue whether I should be graduating or not. But I think, I had a big lack of conformity with the systems in schooling. And I didn't feel I belonged within the schooling cycle, or I didn't feel that the schooling cycle served any purpose. I felt it was more of a mechanism of, you know, command and control. And it's a way that something that everybody has to do. And I've asked the questions, you know, ever since, you know, I was maybe 7 years. Why do we have to do this?
Yeah.
And I've never had an answer, you know, until now. My parents didn't know why. They just said, you know, everybody has to go to school, you go to school. The teachers didn't know why. Everybody has to go to school, you go to school. And my colleagues definitely did not know why. So who was I in a classroom? Most of the time, whenever I could get away with it, I wasn't in the classroom. But I enjoyed the school setup. I enjoyed the community. I enjoyed the feeling of peers and the group situation more than it is the actual schooling program.
Yeah. So the learning for you, you could basically, you understood very quickly in your young age that you could learn outside of the, you know, the whatever traditional system was in place.
I don't think I understood that far. I understood that I did not need whatever was being taught in the classroom. I had a very radical opinion at the time. And I remember first day of university, I called my father and I said, the guy who is teaching us business makes $50,000 a year.
Yeah.
How does that work? You know, if this guy knew so much of business, he would be doing business,
right?
And that's where I felt there was a big disconnect between life and the schooling system. And I still do feel, until today, people mix schooling and education.
Yeah.
A schooled person is not necessarily educated, and an educated person is not necessarily schooled. Especially when you look at this part of the world, any part of the world, actually. If you look at tech as a space, most of the very well-educated tech people who know technology are not very well schooled.
Yeah.
They've left school earlier, they've let go of the schooling system and so on. So there is a massive confusion between if you're schooled, you're educated. That's not necessarily true. I think it's very false. And if you are educated, it doesn't mean you've picked up your education at school.
Yeah.
So that's how I feel.
So the smartest kids today are people that can create their own curriculum and they can learn from platforms such as whatever YouTube and different other platform, or because you still have an issue with that kind of how many people can really educate themselves versus
so smart is a relative term. Who is smart? Is the richest guy smart, or is the guy who's writing more code smart, or is the nuclear physicist smart? I don't think smart is a specific metric that applies across the board. But if you look at, you know, the corporate world, there are people who do better. There is a scoreboard.
Yeah.
You know, the financial metric is the scoreboard. There are individuals and organizations that do better than others, and there are some that don't do very well. And we tend to see a very clear metric that the more schooled you are, the less well you do.
Yeah.
In the corporate world, whether you're smart or not becomes out of the question, because when I pick up 10 kids who obviously I know for a fact at the starting line, they're all smart. Nobody is born not smart or with lower intellectual ability. You have different kinds of smart, but you know they're all smart. And you keep trying to uniform force them into a uniform shape of a schooling system. Eventually, whoever was smart differently, you've diminished that intellect.
Yeah.
You've literally beat it out of them for 10, 12, 13, 14, however long you have them in school. And you've kept telling them for 10, 12, 13 years that, you know, the Pythagorean theorem is the most important thing in the world. And if you don't know how to calculate the area of a triangle, you're an idiot. But by the time they're done with school, the Pythagorean theorem and the area of the triangle doesn't help them do any better in life. And that becomes, you've sort of produced synthetic stupidity and synthetic incompetence.
Yeah.
Because today you see it, and it's unfortunate. You know, you have generations of brilliant people that are graduating unfit and unable to join the workforce. They need a big phase of reconditioning to be able to operate in a work environment. That is because the schooling environment is super synthetic, both socially and educationally, to the point where I feel there is very little you can take with you.
It's super powerful that you said a word reconditioning and not upskilling, reskilling. It's almost a condition that have been, you know, layers after layers, years after year, have basically reduced the capacity of that person to use its full potential.
Yes, 100%. So that is a human being who survived, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of years of natural selection.
Yeah.
They're hardwired to survive. They're hardwired instinctively to perform miracles. But you condition them for such a long time to tell them, whatever this piece of paper that this institution is going to give you, this is what you are. You are an accountant.
Mm.
That's it.
Yeah.
All you're good at is numbers. Don't think outside the accounting sphere. Don't you dare, you know, think about engineering or manufacturing or doing anything else. This piece of paper is deciding who you are from now probably until the end of your life. And that's extremely limiting, for one. The other part is most of those pieces of paper do not give you an actual skill to perform.
Yeah.
And that's why you'd find out that, you know, somebody who is a carpenter or a skilled worker probably will fare financially better than an educated or a schooled individual in that regard. And I think that just puts a very big question mark on, do you need the educational system as it exists today? Because you have very clear metrics, you know, and intellectuals, you know, they came up with data science, right? The data tells you the less schooled you are, you do better.
Especially in today's world.
You do better in the world. It also tells you that schooling slows you down from financial productivity, and that's a massive problem for at least this part of the world.
Yeah.
That can you actually afford 14 years or 15 years of no income is a big question.
It is, yeah.
The third part is that education sets you back financially. How many families and individuals do you know that have a financial burden caused by education and or by formal education? I think those metrics are clean. I think those are undisputable facts that we are seeing today. But when you go through under that layer, fine, I'll go through the financial struggle. I'll spend 14 years, which is a very long amount of time. I'll take my family into debt with me. But when you graduate me, I can't work.
Yeah,
I am not.
Are you expecting, because of those years of education, you're expecting that the market will come in and just take you for...
Unfortunately...
It's not the case anymore.
You're unemployable.
Yeah.
It's not like I can employ you at a low salary. It's not like... Most of the time, there's a 12-year-old kid that can do this better. And that becomes a foundational question for education. What are you educating people for? Why? What is the process? Is the same process? Everything has, with technology, everything with the movement of time has evolved and became more efficient. Delivering mail used to take a few days, a few hours, a few seconds. Now it's instant. Education 100 years ago was 14 years of school. 8 hours. It's still the same.
Which hasn't changed. It's one of the field that has not. It's like a mammoth. It's a dinosaur. It haven't changed. And we in the field, we are trying to, to push the.
And this becomes the question of why are you telling me that this now ancient process is going to land me in a better off position.
Yeah.
If I don't go through your process. And back to your question, can everybody educate themselves? No, obviously not. And they're not supposed to. Formal education in one way or another has existed since the beginning of time, whether it was father to son, or whether it was madrasas, or whether it was kutabs. There has always been some sort of formal education institute at the core of every thriving nation. But I'm sure if we go back through time, there was a kind of formal education that was much more successful in preparing more productive graduates than what we have today.
Would you separate, and this is the last question about education, because I want to go to the founder journey. Would you separate the objective of education between creating citizen and good citizen, aware of their immediate environment, aware of the global environment, versus just pure preparation for the market?
What is good? What's a good citizen? Is a good citizen a productive citizen? Is a good citizen a citizen that pays their taxes?
Values and principles. Universal.
Values and principles, we can agree, are not universal, especially in this day and age. You have about half of the free world, about 120 countries in the United Nations, saying the world's moral compass should point somewhere.
Yeah.
And one person says no.
Yeah.
And we follow the opinion of one person.
Or we abide by
it. We abide by it. Does that mean that values and principles are universal?
Powerful, yeah.
Probably not. What values and principles are you trying to push people? And that's a very ethical, philosophical question that people have been trying to answer since the beginning of time. But when you look at a place like the Middle East, or you look at Qatar, or you look at the UAE, what is a good citizen? I think a good citizen in the realm that we are in is somebody who pushes the wheel of development forward. If you are idle, you're not pushing anything forward. If you are idle, you're extra weight on the economy. If you are not productive, you're pulling everybody back just a little bit. Yeah. And, there is a saying, in economics, we say the well-being of all of us is dependent on the financial well-being of each and every one of us.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you have, at a core layer, each individual can spend, can move dollars into the economy, can produce value, whether it's financial or otherwise, can produce new science, new technology, new methods of doing things, and so on and so forth, then you probably end up with a better, more productive, let's say, community.
A more
productive social collective. I don't know if it's going to be a good social collective or a bad social collective. That's more ethical, and I'm not an expert on ethics. But what we have today is an education system that doesn't do either.
Mm.
There is an educational system that has been spending the past 20 years teaching people about humanitarian law and international law, and you clearly see it tossed out in the garbage.
Mm.
If you bring in any 10 people between the age of 10 and 40, and you ask them, do you believe in all of the international humanitarian bodies, especially as a Middle Eastern in the Middle East? Probably don't.
Yeah.
But you spend how long learning about those in humanities, in universities and colleges? And that's one part that the education system is definitely not taking care of. But the other part is you're also not making them productive.
Yeah.
In fact, when they go out to the real world, they have to spend a very long time getting reconditioned to understand how does real life work. Because the setup you've made in a schooling system is so synthetic to the point where all the walls are cushioned. You're never confronted at school. You're never in a place of challenge or altercation at school. There is always a father figure or a mother figure that, keeps the world at balance. And those things don't exist in real life. There is no teacher that tells the bad guys to, stop talking or keeps the bullies at bay in real life. But we almost grow up with that expectation. So my third observation would be you're making them, you're not giving them the values, you're not giving them the financial literacy or the actual productivity literacy they need, but you're also making a very fragile generation, one that is not ready for altercation, confrontation, any stress, any hard time. It's almost we send our schools to school, our kids to school now with the expectation of zero stress. He needs to be, very good food. Everybody should be nice to each other. The teacher should always hug you and take care of you. If you do very bad, they should give you a participation trophy just because you went. Great. You are instilling fragility into those kids. This kid is going to go to work tomorrow expecting a participation trophy. But guess what? He's going to get fired. Nobody's going to come and tell him, oh, you performed fifth best this year. Let us give you a medal. That's not going to happen. But now that is almost becoming the expectation.
It is. I observe it in the new generation we hire. And look, this is a topic. If we get to this tangent, I think we can spend hours on it. I do wanna understand the journey of the founder. So we spoke about education. I see the very strong belief in the way that we could learn completely out of the system, and I do appreciate that. And if you look at people with a level of capacity in the last 20 years, so you did have a phase of the super capable 20 years ago, they used to go to politics. And then we've seen a change where the most kind of capable, they go to consulting or private banking. And now we see a new trend where the most capable are folks who say, you know what, I see a problem, I want to fix it. And have you gone through this journey? I'm super curious about founders, what age you started your first company? Just quick question.
14.
Yeah. Okay, now give me the adult version now. The very serious business, what age?
19, 20.
What happened in your brain to say, I want to fix, and you wanted to fix a problem?
Yeah.
Right? So can you walk us through that kind of, what happened in your brain to say, I want to fix this problem? Is it money driven or driven by really the objective of fixing a problem for the collective? And
So let me just backtrack to where the most capable go. The most capable people historically never change direction, ever. The most capable always fixed problems. Politics is a tool to fix problems. Banking is a tool to fix problems. The most capable person of the last generation was Rockefeller or Rothschild. And they're bankers, and the other guy ran an oil conglomerate and a train business and a steel business. The only difference is if you look back in time and name, I don't know, who do you think historically is one of the most grand figures for you? Like who?
Oh, there's many. I mean, yeah.
Name a few.
Historically speaking, I mean, some of the people you just named are impressive. But coming from one part of the world, right?
Yeah. So even if you look at any part of the world, if you look at... And I'll just break this down a bit. If you look at Rockefeller, he started an oil business, a train business, a steel business that were all the biggest in the world.
Yeah.
I don't know what school he went to, right? But he was not confounded by anything. Nobody told him, because you're really good at doing steel, you can't start a train business. Or because you're very good at railways, you can't start an oil business. Mm. He did whatever he thought was opportunistic, and he made it happen. If you look at someone else, Abe Lincoln, he was a lawyer, very good one. He was a very good businessman, and was a very good president.
Mm.
And he was not, and I don't know what school he went to either, but he was not lined up by the conformity of, you're a politician, be a politician, that's it. Because that's, he was an army commander, he was, you know.
Yeah.
So there is no, historically, there has never been a limitation on human capability. If you come and fast forward, you look at somebody like Mohammed bin Rashid. He is an engineer. He's an urban planner. Anybody that goes to Dubai says this is the best city in the world. He built the best airline in the world. He built the best city in the world. And he was Minister of Interior and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Nobody told him you were a politician.
Just stay there.
Stay in parliament and, you know, push paper all day long.
Yeah.
Same thing if you look at, you know, the leadership in Qatar. There is a lot of efforts that are non-political efforts that happen. And thus you end up with a community or a society that has shakers and movers. The issue with the education system is it's brought everybody up and told them, here is your number, here is what you are. This is what it says. Stick to this. So founders usually are, and that back to the educational plot of things, the only thing that I could find in common between all successful founders that I've ever met or talked to or read about is their ability to deal with turbulation. They're all founders in many different ways and senses, and everybody has a different success story and how they started, and you know that formula varies. But the one constant that you would almost find across the board in every single kind of founder or successful person is they have the ability to deal with turbulation a lot more than everybody else. It's almost, Ray Dalio says, it's almost, you know, the founders and entrepreneurs, it's almost like they look forward to the problems. To the,
yeah.
There is a sense of, I want a problem. I don't want, you know, I don't want the peaceful manner of having. I want to go and chase an issue. Stress, pressure, all the things that they tell you in school are unhealthy and that you should not be dealing with.
It's the reality of, yeah.
Because that's where problems are solved. And problems are only solved by people who are willing to say, I am willing to, you know, pay the price of being under enormous amounts of stress that nobody else wants to be under. I am willing to pay the price of failing, which is what they teach you at school. You either pass or fail. And you're two opposites. You're either a success or a failure. But in real life, them who fail most succeed most.
Yeah.
I failed a lot at school. They never passed me because I failed a lot. But that's what school almost gives you, the intuition that, you know, if you're not a success, you're a failure. And that's how life is broken. But failing is a gateway to success. There are no people who succeed
without
passing through that.
Yeah.
But what is the problem with failure? Why is it so dark? And because it's very stressful to fail.
Hmm.
It's very shameful to fail. We don't have an innate humility as human beings to accept it, that couldn't do this, and I'm not good enough to do this. And you always hear those words and those phrases flying around in formal education, you're good enough to do anything. No, you're not. And you're not supposed to be good enough at everything. And here is where you need to fail. And you need to be understanding of your actual strengths and weaknesses and your situation. And your ability to go through that journey will make you entrepreneurial. Whether your entrepreneurship is a financial one or an ethical one, or there are, you know, many kinds of entrepreneurship out there. And that's where success comes from.
So your journey of founder.
My journey of founder started with the fact that I never fit in. Yeah. I don't think I ever fit in.
Yeah.
I never had many friends. I never was the most popular.
You don't come across as an introvert.
I'm not an introvert, but I'm also not interested in a lot of socializing. Because unfortunately, and I don't know how politically correct this phrase is, but my father used to use it a lot. He's like, the more people in a room, the more stupid opinions you have. So you don't really need to socialize. Which is, again, the opposite of what you're taught, is you need to socialize with everyone. Everyone needs to like you. Everyone needs to love you. Well, I'm not running for office, so I'm not really trying to be the most popular person ever. And that's that. So I never fit in. And I knew for a fact I will never do any well in the corporate world.
Because of that.
Yeah, I will never do well at a job. I'll never be able to sit for 8 or 9 hours at a desk and fill in report for things that I don't like to do, things I don't understand the purpose of. And that's a big problem with a lot of people. They don't understand the purpose of what they're doing. Most kids at school don't understand the purpose of why they are studying what they're studying, or the fact that, okay, why am I reading about some guy who died 3,000 years ago who invented instant noodles or whatever they teach about those days, right? It doesn't help me. It doesn't do anything for me. Let alone when you have a kid, we're looking at schooling as well from a very privileged angle. Let alone when you have a kid who had to probably walk 10 kilometers to school, whose parents live on less than $1 a day, who has to sit there and listen to you lecture him about Confucius. How's Confucius going to make his family's life any better?
Mm.
Right? Not that I have anything against Confucius. I love Confucius.
I got the point, though.
There is a level of practicality that you need to hit. And that level of practicality is, how does education really improve that person's life? And a lot of the time is not how it works today. So my journey started with this lack of conformity, the fact that I don't buy a lot of what is taught in school. I don't believe in a lot of the metrics that people put out there. And I remember all the time, the talk in school was, if your grades are A's and B's, you're going to do very well in life. And I was like, probably not. Probably not. And I've never had A's or B's, so.
If you remember anyone in your class,
many people
who got the A's, is probably not as far today?
I don't want to compare to my classmates. I'm sure all of them did wonderfully well. I have lost touch with many of them, but I see for a fact that if you do very well in school, you're not conditioned to do well because there is no playbook.
Yeah.
In school, somebody gives you the playbook and you just have to read this for that and answer this for that. And it's a multiple choice kind of life. And those people don't perform very well. I'll tell you a small story. There is a guy I knew is one of the most brilliant people, went in high school, was, you know, super performer, went to one of the best Ivy Leagues, super performer again, went into one of the bigger banks. A bit into consulting, then a bit into banking, was a great banker, then decided to start his own company. And within, you know, I think a year from starting his own company, all of a sudden, you know, we hear about this guy and he tries to basically like throw himself off of a window or something. Oh. And I really, like, I'm usually not interested in the stories of what's happening.
Yeah.
And other people's lives, but I really wanted to understand, how do you go from
that to
from the kid, you know, edge. Every parents wanted their kid to be into trying to off yourself. And apparently, like, I spoke to him, I spoke to a bunch of people who worked with him, and you won't believe the reason was one bad phone call with an investor.
Oh wow.
Where the investor apparently abused that person, shouted at them or what have you, and it just shook them so deeply that nobody shouted at you at school. Nobody confronted you in school.
Yeah.
Nobody confronted you when you were, you know, the best consultant in the room. You were never, you know, liable to deliver anything. You were just pushing paper. And now, all of a sudden, you're a business. You're responsible for people's livelihoods. You're responsible for your users. And that person, you know, could not handle that kind of pressure.
Yeah.
And that was the breaking point. You know, that person broke. And
character building is missing in the education system.
Actually, it's character diminishing. You know, you might end up with a neutral generation if you don't build them, but you diminish them.
Mm.
But then that's not, you know, you can't be an entrepreneur if that's your expectation. You can't lead on other responsibilities or other be responsible for other people's if that's the expectation. It's very difficult.
You're leading an amazing tech company out of the region. We had for many years the belief that we can't have amazing companies coming out of the region. Amazing companies have to come from Silicon Valley or, you know, much bigger markets.
Yeah.
We know a lot of amazing companies came out of China in the good years of China when they allowed tech to flourish.
Yeah.
Are you bullish about the market, and are you optimistic about the future of the region to let more Abdallahs, you know, blossom here?
I can very, you know, with a lot of humility say there is many better founders and entrepreneurs that I see shaping up than myself. And, you know, they do a great job, and I have massive, younger, better, faster, more aggressive, and I have massive respect for a lot of them. But I want to go back and blame the education system one more time for that as well. It's because we've always been taught, you know, if you are going to be smart, you need a Harvard degree. If you were like, there is always this halo around the Ivy League graduate. Really, you know, no. you don't need Harvard graduates to build big businesses. Actually, most of the big businesses that were built were not built by Ivy graduates or any graduate at all. And that's one kind of look, which I think now is starting to... There is the realization that, you know, they're just as human.
Mm.
And that's an important one. I think with Astra, my vision had always been with every business that I've built is that we're good enough to compete. We're actually much better at competing on our own turf than waiting for somebody else to solve the problem, package it and ship it to us for $9.99 plus tax, right?
Yeah.
It's we don't need that. And I think whether, you know, and this is something to most of the founders here. For better or for worse, this is our market.
Yeah.
And we will not get another one.
Yeah.
for better or for worse, there needs to be people who will invest in this region.
Yeah.
You have the option. If you're a smart individual, if you're a founder, if you're an entrepreneur and you are up to great things, you'll always have the option. And it's not a financial decision. It might pay off better to be in the valley or to be whatever kind of company and in the West. But you're not going to get another Middle East. This is where you're from. This is your market. This is where you need to... If not you, who? Like, this is the thing is, we see this in the Middle East a lot, where there is always the passing on of responsibility to the next generation, or somebody's going to come and fit. Who? Who's the you know, knight in shining armor? Who's the mystic savior? Nobody's coming. You know, it's us. It's myself and the people I work with, and the people they work with, and the people that are going to work with, and you, and the people you work with, and the people you influence. That's it. If those people give up, then on this part of the world, or they start thinking, oh, I could have gotten better multiples elsewhere, or I've gotten, yeah, you could have, you probably would. But you're building somebody else's supremacy. You're building somebody else's future. And for better or worse, I think, a lot of the world is now realizing that maybe we don't want to build for somebody else. Mm. Maybe we really want to put our eggs in our own basket. And that's how I look at it. A lot of other entrepreneurs might be financially smarter than I am, and they look at things with, you know, better Excel sheets, and they see a lot more return. But for me, I fundamentally believe in building for this part of the world and in exporting what we do. Today, with Astra, we have 200 million users. That's much bigger. Most of our users are not in the Middle East.
Impressive, yeah.
But we build here.
Southeast Asia, mainly?
Yeah, Southeast Asia. We're very big in the Philippines. We're very big in Pakistan. We're very big in India. And we're proud of that because we're exporting from here to there. And we are telling the world, you know, you can have a solution that comes from this part of the world and it could work very well for you. And I'm proud of that. I think, yeah, maybe if we've done a lot of things out of the U.S., maybe we would have gotten
We need more and more founders, successful founder from the region, because that could...
We need more
role models.
We need more failing founders.
We need a better culture of accepting.
Look at the U.S. I think there's a very respectable thing that's in the valley. You know, every failure is a badge of honor.
Yeah. There's some investor will not even invest
in you,
in a founder that is just
first time founder.
Yeah. Go fail. Yeah, fail bad and fail.
Fail
quick,
bad, fail
back.
Quick, fail front, and it's fine. It's okay. I think there is a lot of a stigma here where, again, it comes from the education system, whether, you know, you're a failure, you opened your company, it didn't work out, shame on you. It's fine. Fail. In fact, you know, fail more and do it with grace. And life of anybody, like... You know, a lot of people try and, you know, sometimes refer to me as successful, but I fail on a daily basis. There's a lot of things that the problem is, people only see the part Forbes wants to see, or Forbes wants to show, or, you know, people want to only see the part that's on camera. But I always tell this to our guys, my team at the office is, I say, if we're not breaking things, if we're not really making mistakes, we're not moving forward.
Is it on your one of the social media? You said built. Did you write this?
I don't manage my social media.
And break fast.
Break things. That's something I always say in the office. Probably. I always say move fast, break things. Yeah, break it. And I always say if you break more things,
you'll solve more things.
You know how those things look like inside. So it's going to be very easy for you to re-put them back together. There are very, very, very few mistakes in life, on the business side at least, that you can't come back from. And case in point, look at Elon Musk. This guy went bankrupt like every other Wednesday for 10 years. Yeah. And eventually that accumulation of so much failure and stress and pressure and sleeping in gyms and whatever he used to do led to what he is today. But What is he today? He's a failing machine. He's still failing. It's not like he said, I'm going to create perfect solutions. His rockets are still blowing up. And he's still trying. X.com is all over the place. But, and the same with everybody else. It's not like they said, oh, we cracked it, then we're successful. That's it. No, they're still trying. And they're still going to work every day in the morning. And they're still trying to figure out a new challenge and a new problem and failing at it. And then some success would come. And I think that should be the mindset.
I think we would need a part two, definitely, because we can go on and on. But I do want to have your insights on a major, major topic related to AI. We had an opportunity a couple of months ago to host Sam Altman in Doha. We interviewed him, and he made some very big quotes that, you know, AI is going to get us 20 times more productive. And so I want to hear your insights on the potential, the challenges, the opportunities that AI is bringing at a personal, but also for businesses.
So again, this is there's nothing new in this. We've seen sort of the same trend, I want to say, happening with the Industrial Revolution. We see it happening with the invention of the steam engine, and so on. And obviously, human productivity is driven. Some people, and that charts sort of an L curve where some people remain below the curve and become labor and skilled worker, and some people use the technology and utilize it and they go above the curve and they become sort of controllers of technology. Yeah. And this happened every time, but I think because now there are more people, just to put it simply, there are more people in the world than there were at the time of the Industrial Revolution. There is more money, so it's just more exponential, and it's just a lot bigger in impact and effect as we would see it. And what I think is going to happen, or what I think AI is doing, is that its education is going to become one of the most obsolete or one of the most hardest hit segments of the community, for sure. Now, There is, and
don't you believe that AI will enhance education from a perspective of we're gonna reach this personalized learning experience
which will kill schooling, yeah, okay. Right? So why do I need to go to university anymore? Why do I need to go if I have, you know, a teacher or a university in my pocket at any given point and so on? I have a faster way to learn and evolve, and it pays. Because if I know how to use AI well, it pays very well. While going to school doesn't really pay. So this is a very, very, very serious point where regulators need to look back and say, what do we do? We need a revamp of the whole operation, right? Yeah.
I don't think that they're ready for it.
They can't be ready. They couldn't have been ready. So the good news is their job is not to predict the future. You know, their job is to adapt to the future. And now the future is here. If we decide to maintain the same education system for the next 10 years, it's going to be very, very useless. And, you know, needless to say, using ChatGPT doesn't cost me as much as going to an Ivy League.
Yeah.
but that's one of the outputs. Is it going to... The problem with increased productivity is, like Sam Altman said, if you increase the productivity of one person by 20x, then that person is as productive as 20 others. What happens to the 20 others?
Yeah.
That's a question.
We're not ready. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Evolution doesn't wait for us to be ready.
Yeah.
It solid. Happens.
Solid. Yeah.
And it's survival of the fittest, right? It's not, that's the thing with the real world. It's not, you don't get a participation trophy. The evolving doesn't really wait for anybody to get ready. It's not like AI is going to come and say, hey, regulators, get ready. By the time we're ready, we're going to come. It's not going to happen. Yeah. It's just going to happen.
It's just going to happen. Yeah.
And some people are going to catch the wave. Some people are going to fall below it. But here becomes the question back to how are we preparing people? The job market is going to look extremely different in 5 years from today. The skill set.
That's tomorrow.
Is going to look very different. The minimum viable or the minimum viable employee, if you will, the minimum viable productive person or workforce looks very different in 5 years from today. And if you're not preparing those people, a lot of people are going to go out to a very, very cold shower and they're not going to understand how it's going to work. And this is going to re-rank nations one more time, just like the Industrial Revolution did. The Industrial Revolution made China a superpower, made the U.S. A lot of what it is today. And AI is going to re-rank the world one more time.
Yeah.
And there are going to be, unfortunately, nations who are going to fall behind.
Yeah.
Even further.
Yeah.
And there are people. There are going to be nations that are going to come forward.
Yeah.
When I say a nation goes up and down, a nation is not an ambiguous body. It's the collective of its individuals. And this is only, you know, a decision where regulators, businesses, and individuals have to take around, do I still want to go, you know, focus on spending 13 years in school to learn whatever it is, or do I start
early to get ready for...
Do I start preparing a generative AI native generation of people? Because it's on. It's a race, right? And the talent is needed. This is happening. We're watching it happen. And parents have the option of, do I teach my son data science and Gen AI, or do I teach him, you know, Confucianism? Becomes a big question.
Yeah.
Is he going to be employable by the time he graduates? Because think about, do you have kids?
Not yet.
Okay. If you have a kid next year, by the time he finishes university, it's going to be 22 years, 23 years from
the
now.
The world will be completely different.
Do you think he's going to be, you know, he's going to need the same skill sets you use today at
not
work?
Not at all.
Right?
Not at all.
But guess what's not going to change? The school, right?
And we're working hard to make that change at WISE.
and it's important, and that's why I think you guys are doing very important work, because it needs to change. It needs to, for your son's sake, for my son's sake, for everybody's kids' sake, there needs to be a change, because our kids cannot do that change for themselves. You can't expect a 3-year-old to decide on the education system they go through. We're deciding on this, and that's our responsibility to decide on it. And if we decide to, you know, opt in, it's going to be, you know, there is a very famous incident in history where the Ottoman Empire was the, you know, the Ottoman Empire was an 800-year-old empire that ruled most of the world, right? And at some point, somebody thought it was a good idea to ban printers.
Oh, yeah, that's in the book of Mustafa Suleiman.
It's in any book that talks about what went wrong with the Ottoman Empire.
He was pushing against that reform until it was imposed on the empire. Yeah.
So somebody thought, and somebody is responsible until today, that empire went away. And that supremacy went away because, but by that minute, what looked at the time as a minor decision, you sent back a whole nation 100 years in time. And other nations that adopted the printer are where they are today. So those decisions might not look very grand and very serious today, but our kids are going to talk about those decisions. Our kids are going to say, you know, my grandfather was the guy that banned the printer. And that's not, I don't think that's a legacy anybody wants to carry.
That, look, I do want to make sure we have an invitation for part two, and because we could deep dive into the topic even further. I really appreciated that. So I'll finish with one thing. Your next move better be?
Your best move.
The best move.
Your best move, yes.
That was an awesome pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.